Have you ever heard the term Judeo-Christian values? I suspect you have. Can you name any of those values? I suspect you can't. But you should, because Judeo-Christian values are the moral foundation of Western civilization. As the great British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher put it, the truths of the Judeo-Christian tradition are infinitely precious, not only because they are true, but also because they provide the moral impulse which alone can lead to that peace for which we all long. Mrs. Thatcher was a believing Christian. I am a believing Jew. While we have different theologies, we have the same core values. And as far as society is concerned, moral values are far more important than theologies. That is why traditionally religious Protestants, Catholics, Mormons, and Jews are aligned on almost every important moral issue. Here, then, are 10 of those values. Number one, there is one God. That God is the God introduced to the world by the Hebrew Bible, or as Christians came to refer to it, the Old Testament. Number two, the Hebrew Bible introduced the most revolutionary moral idea in history, that there are objective moral truths, just as there are objective mathematical and scientific truths. Without God, there is no moral truth, only moral opinions. Number three, because there are moral truths, good and evil are the same for all people. Number four, God, not man, not government, not popular opinion, not a democratic vote, is the source of our rights. The American Declaration of Independence declares that all men are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. Number five, the human being is created in the image of God. Therefore, every human life is precious, and therefore race is of no significance because God has no race. Number six, the world is based on divine order, and order is made by distinctions. Among these divine distinctions are God and man, God and nature, man and woman, human and animal, good and evil. Number seven, man is not basically good. Christians speak of original sin in referring to man's nature. Jews cite what God said in Genesis, the will of man's heart is evil from his youth. Both beliefs are diametrically opposed to the naive modern belief that man is basically good. And they lead to the same conclusion. We need God-based rules to keep us from our natural inclinations. Number eight, therefore, our natural inclinations are a very poor moral guide. As religious Jews and Christians put it, don't follow your heart. A lot of terrible things have been done and are being done now by people thinking their hearts are better guides than Judeo-Christian values. Number nine, human beings have free will and are therefore responsible for how they behave. In the secular world, free will does not exist because all human behavior is the result of biology and environment. And if there is no free will, people are not responsible for what they do, good or bad. Number 10, the Ten Commandments. They are the core of Judeo-Christian values. In fact, if everyone lived just by the Ten Commandments, we wouldn't need armies or even police. There's another important aspect to the term Judeo-Christian. The two religions need each other. Without the Old Testament, there is no New Testament. Virtually every Christian moral principle derives from the Hebrew Bible. Not only the 10 Judeo-Christian values I just enumerated, but such basic moral principles as love your neighbor as yourself, love the Lord your God, and love the stranger. At the same time, Jews need Christians. It was overwhelmingly Christians who carried knowledge of the Hebrew Bible to the world. Judeo-Christian refers to one other fact. No religions in the world share a common revelation the way Judaism and Christianity do. That common revelation is the Hebrew Bible. The only two religions that share that Bible or any sacred work are Judaism and Christianity. The ultimate embodiment of Judeo-Christian values has been the United States of America. America's founders were Christians, some culturally, some theologically, who were rooted in the Old Testament. So much so that Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin designed a seal for the United States that depicted God leading Israel out of Egypt, just as they believed God was leading America out of Europe. Only if we keep these values will we keep America, and for that matter, Western civilization. I'm Dennis Prager. Thank you for watching this video. To keep PragerU videos free, please consider making a tax-deductible donation.
Congrats! You made it. You finished college. You got good grades. Okay, passing grades. Now you're gonna get a good job. Okay, a job. In 20 years, maybe you'll pay off your student loans. After working for another 30 years, you may finally be able to retire and take that cruise to Aruba you always talk about. And then, you die. What a joke. Is this really what God or the universe or your mother had in mind for you? Who decided this is the path to success? The woke colleges that teach you almost nothing of real value? The corporations that need well-behaved worker bees to reach their quarterly targets? The government that takes half your income and then wastes it? I'm here to tell you that there is another way. I know, because I'm living it. I dropped out of high school at 14. I worked minimum wage jobs when minimum meant something, as in next to nothing. I lived out of my car and camped in parks. And yet here I am, one of the most watched personalities on the internet. I employ a bunch of people, and I make more than the minimum wage. How did I get here without a college degree? As someone once said, I never let my schooling interfere with my education. My parents owned a coffee house in Chicago. I did a little bit of everything. And while I was cleaning, cooking, or cashiering, I was also soaking up the banter, learning about culture, politics, and why Jason hated the Republican Party. That was my education. I didn't have some grand plan for my life. Actually, I didn't have any plan. I just worked hard. Whether I was handing out extra crispy fries at the drive-thru window or freezing my ass off hauling luggage at O'Hare, I was always excited about what I was doing because I knew my next job and the one after that would be better. In my early 20s, I began a career in activism. I fundraised on behalf of Greenpeace and other environmental nonprofits, and I was damn good at it. In fact, I was always one of their top fundraisers. But I walked away when I discovered that the green these organizations claimed to care about was not the environment. Around that time, rumors began circulating on the internet about something called Occupy Wall Street. The plan was for thousands of people to storm the streets of New York because they felt that the rich were being bailed out during an economic crisis they caused. Meanwhile, the middle class and the poor were being crushed. It seemed interesting, so I thought it was worth checking out. I bought a round-trip bus ticket to New York, planning to stay there for a week. I stayed 6 years. Multiple times a day, I would live stream and post photos of what was happening. When the epicenter of the protest at Zuccotti Park was raided by the police, I began what became a 22-hour straight live stream. Time magazine picked up my story. My career in media had officially begun. I was receiving phone calls, emails, book offers from every media organization you can probably think of. But I had already learned my lesson. I did not trust that they knew what they were doing, especially with new technology. So I went independent. I worked my ass off. I reported on anything I thought was interesting, always posting, posting, posting. Now that I had built a foundation, I had leverage. I went to Vice. I didn't ask them for a job. I told them the job they would make for me. They agreed. But as corporate media began to change and embrace the cult-like ideology of wokeness, I realized I couldn't stay there. If I wanted to tell the truth, I had to do it myself. Fast forward 6 years and I now have my own media empire. The Timcast Network has over 4 million subscribers, over 1 billion views, and 2 songs on Apple's top 10 list. And yeah, I'm still working my ass off. In short, I trusted myself more than I trusted my teachers or my managers or the people running the companies I worked for. Whatever value they assigned me, represented by a report card or a title or a paycheck, wouldn't have an impact on my success. How about you? Do you believe in yourself enough to chart your own course so that you can one day do what you really want to do? For me, it's working for myself. For you, it could be getting to the C-suite of a Fortune 500 corporation, or staying at home and raising a family, or becoming a cattle rancher. There are a million good options. I'm not going to make any judgments about what you want to do. My life-changing advice? Well, sorry, I don't have any. Except maybe this. Work, keep working, and then work harder. I figured it out. Your turn. I'm Tim Pool, host of TimCast for Prager University.
The public's reaction to the deadly beating of Tyre Nichols in Memphis in January 2023 has been virtually unanimous. A clear-cut case of police brutality. The cops agree. Police executives, rank-and-file officers, and union representatives from across the country also expressed their strong disapproval. The president of the Fraternal Order of Police, Patrick Yose, denounced the incident as a criminal assault under the pretext of law. NYPD Commissioner Keyshawn Sewell described the Memphis officer's conduct as disgraceful. Here's why they're right. After the initial encounter with Nichols, body cam footage shows one officer saying to another that Nichols made me pepper spray myself. A second officer seemed agitated at having had his glasses knocked off during the struggle, later saying, "I hope they stomp his ass." A third appeared to have hurt his leg in the melee. But none of this excuses kicks to the head, punches to the face, or baton strikes doled out to a man who was not resisting. What it looked like was an unjustifiable beating handed out by hotheads. Though it's little consolation to Nichols's family, Memphis authorities didn't hesitate in punishing the offending officers. All five were swiftly terminated, arrested, and indicted for their outrageous behavior. But this isn't enough for some. "We need to show the world what lessons we can learn from this tragedy," District Attorney Steve Mulroy said during the press conference in which the charges were announced. "Perhaps the lesson is simply this. Policing is a human endeavor and is therefore subject to the shortcomings of inherently flawed human beings, which means that some people, cops included, will sometimes act out of malevolence." To the activists, however, bad police officers are not the exception, they're the rule. Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, for example, grumbled about the effort to separate the officers who murdered Tyre Nichols from the system of policing that produced them, going on to assert that charges alone aren't justice, change is. But there's good reason to separate the officers who beat Nichols from the institution of policing. Their actions constituted a sharp departure from police training and practice. The available data show this to be true. What activists often term police violence, contrary to what you may have heard, is extremely rare. This becomes clear once you view use of force numbers in their proper context. Unjustifiable force is even rarer. According to data compiled by Police Scorecard, a website built by left-wing police critic Samuel Sinyagwe, Memphis police had been involved in 25 killings between 2013 and 2021, a period in which Memphis police officers made some 288,000 arrests, to say nothing of other encounters such as traffic and pedestrian stops. Now let's look at the biggest department in the country. Between 2017 and 2021, the NYPD fielded more than 30 million calls for service and made over 1 million arrests. Over that same period, New York City cops fired their weapons in just 0.02% of arrests and used force of any kind in 3.5% of arrests. In other departments, force rates are even lower. A 2018 study found that over a two-year period, officers across three police departments in North Carolina, Arizona, and Louisiana fielded over 1 million calls for service. They made more than 114,000 arrests and used force of any kind in less than 1% of those. And just one of those encounters involved a fatal police shooting. The deplorable actions depicted in the Memphis videos are simply not representative of policing as an institution. It's also worth noting that police reform advocates have gotten a lot of what they wanted over the last several years. Between June 2020 and April 2021, 30 states enacted more than 140 police reform measures, according to the New York Times. City councils and police departments also enacted reforms of their own. That includes the Memphis PD. These reforms may constitute wins for activists demanding change, but have they made our streets safer? The public doesn't seem to think so. In a 2022 poll of likely voters across the country, more than two-thirds of respondents said that they felt less safe than they did 2 years prior. Their fears are well-founded. In 2020, America saw a 30% increase in homicides, the single largest one-year spike in over 100 years. The Major City Chiefs Association, representing 70 police departments, reported that in 2022, there were roughly 36% more aggravated assaults than there were in 2019. The crime spike has hit Black communities the hardest. A recent study found that in 2021, Black men were shot to death at a rate not seen since 1990, meaning that in just a few years, all of the progress that community has seen over the past quarter century was lost. As much as some might want to deny it, a thin blue line divides order from chaos. Police brutality should never be tolerated, and we should work to reduce it. But making good policy requires an honest look at the data. And the data say that police brutality is the exception, not the rule. I'm Rafael Mengual, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute and author of Criminal Injustice for Prager University.
Zachary Taylor, the 12th president of the United States, was so indifferent to politics that he never voted until his own election in 1848. A career military man, Old Rough and Ready, as he was affectionately known, was weathered, stocky, and bow-legged in appearance. He was obstinate, easily insulted, and quick-tempered in character. These are not traits that usually make for a successful politician. But then again, he never wanted to be a politician until he did. The son of a Revolutionary War veteran, Zachary Taylor was born in Orange County, Virginia on November 24, 1784. Inspired by his father's military exploits, Taylor joined the army in 1808. He spent the bulk of the next 40 years protecting the frontier against hostile Indians. Steadily rising from the rank of lieutenant to brigadier general, he fought in the War of 1812, the Black Hawk War of 1832, and the Second Seminole War in 1837. The Mexican-American War in 1846 was a turning point in Taylor's life. In a matter of months, he went from a respected but obscure soldier to a national hero. Here's how it happened. In January of 1846, President James Polk sent Taylor into the disputed border territory of Texas and Mexico. The idea was that the presence of American troops would pressure the Mexican government into accepting Polk's offer to buy California. But Mexico wasn't interested, so Polk was stuck. Things became unstuck when Mexican forces fired on Taylor's men near the town of Palo Alto, killing 11. That's all Polk needed to ask Congress to declare war, which it did on May 12th. At that moment, the war rested on Taylor's shoulders. Despite being vastly outnumbered, he won the Battle of Palo Alto and went on to score impressive victories at Monterey and Buena Vista. Ulysses S. Grant, a recent West Point graduate who took part in the campaign, said of Taylor, "No soldier could face either danger or responsibility more calmly than he. He was known to every soldier in his army and was respected by all." The Mexican War ended in February 1848, with the U.S. acquiring not only California, but vast swaths of land in the American Southwest. Within weeks of the end of the war, the Whig Party, which had done so well with war hero William Henry Harrison, saw Taylor as their ticket back to the White House. Taylor was intrigued, but he didn't see himself as a party man. "I am a Whig, but not an ultra Whig," he said. "If elected, I would not be the mere president of a party. I would endeavor to act independent of party." That was good enough for the Whigs. In short order, they nominated Taylor to be their standard bearer. He went on to defeat Lewis Cass, a Democratic senator from Michigan, in the general election. Being a war general was hard, but being president was harder. For one thing, the Mexican-American War had reignited the slavery debate. How would all this new territory be integrated into the Union? What part would be slave? What part would be free? The political balance stood precariously at 15 free states and 15 slave states. Any additional states would tip the scales one way or the other. How would this be resolved? If anyone was in a position to resolve it, Taylor seemed to be that man. Like many in the South, he was a slave owner. He owned plantations in Louisiana, Mississippi, and Kentucky with over 300 slaves. Like many in the North, he opposed the expansion of slavery into the new territories. Furthermore, he was strongly pro-Union. When aggrieved Southerners threatened secession, Taylor bluntly informed them that he would hang any traitors with less reluctance than the deserters and spies in Mexico. So what did Taylor do? Not what most expected him to do, certainly not his supporters in the South. He endorsed immediate statehood for California and New Mexico, both of which were likely to become free states. As serious talk of civil war arose in Congress and across the country, an aging Henry Clay struggled to engineer one last grand bargain. Here in part is what he proposed. California would be admitted as a free state. The territories of New Mexico and Utah would decide for themselves whether to be free or slave. And to appease the South, the Fugitive Slave Act, requiring runaway slaves to be returned to their owners, would be strengthened. Taylor would have none of it. First of all, he disliked Henry Clay. He thought that Clay never gave him the respect he felt he deserved. If Clay was for it, Taylor was against it. But second, he adamantly opposed the Fugitive Slave Act. Because of Taylor's opposition, Clay's grand bargain got nowhere. And that's where things stood when Taylor died suddenly in the summer of 1850. Had he lived, could he have found a way to bridge the gap between North and South, free and slave? We'll never know. I'm Joseph Forneri, professor of political science at the Rochester Institute of Technology and director of the Center for Statesmanship, Law, and Liberty for Prager University. Thank you for watching this video. To keep PragerU videos free, please consider making a tax-deductible donation.
The world needs more fossil fuels, more oil, coal, and natural gas, not less. Does that sound crazy? It's actually not. Not if you employ one common sense principle. It's the same principle you use when you decide whether to take a prescription drug. Carefully weigh the benefits and the negative side effects. If the benefits of using fossil fuels outweigh the negative side effects, then we should keep using fossil fuels. If the negative side effects outweigh the benefits, then we should stop using fossil fuels as soon as possible. Which is it? It turns out that the benefits of fossil fuels far outweigh the negative side effects. The reason that most so-called experts, including many climate scientists, are against fossil fuels is that they violate this principle. They ignore the benefits of fossil fuels while overstating their negative side effects. To know the truth about the benefits and side effects of fossil fuels, you need to understand 8 essential facts. Fact 1. Cost-effective energy is essential to human flourishing. This is almost never discussed, but no one can dispute it. Low-cost, reliable, versatile energy makes modern life possible. There's a simple reason for this. Energy powers the machines that allow us to be productive and prosperous, from the combine harvesters that allow one farm worker to do the work of 1,000, to the incubators that save the lives of millions of premature babies. Everything depends on energy. Thanks to the unprecedented availability of cost-effective energy, overwhelmingly fossil fuel energy, the world has never been a better place for human life. Life expectancy has risen sharply, and extreme poverty, those that earn less than $2 per day, has plummeted from 42% in 1980 to less than 10% today. Fact 2. Billions of people are suffering and dying for lack of energy. Most of us take cost-effective energy for granted, but much of the world doesn't have that luxury. 3 billion individuals use less electricity per year than a typical American refrigerator. Most of them must use wood and animal dung to heat their homes and cook their food. To flourish, these people need far more energy. Fact 3. Fossil fuels are uniquely cost-effective. 80% of the world's energy comes from fossil fuels. And fossil fuel use is still growing. The reason? Nothing else can provide billions of people in thousands of places with low-cost, reliable, versatile energy. Unreliable solar and wind can't come close. They only provide electricity, which is just 1/5 of the world's energy use. And because solar and wind can go to near zero at any time, they depend on 24/7 backup from reliable power plants, usually powered by fossil fuels. Fact 4. Fossil fuel energy neutralizes climate danger. Climate disaster deaths are down 98% over the last century. How did this happen? much of the credit goes to fossil fuels. They power the machinery that helps us construct sturdy buildings, the heating and air conditioning systems that protect us from extreme temperatures, and the irrigation and transportation systems that alleviate drought. Fact 5. Global warming has been mild and manageable. While we're told that the warming we've experienced is rapid and overwhelming, the world has warmed just 1 degree Celsius, 2 degrees Fahrenheit, since widespread fossil fuel use and CO2 emissions began in the 1800s. And because CO2 is actually plant food, more CO2 has led to significant global greening. That means more trees, more plants, more food. Fact 6. Warmer temperatures will save lives. While the media portray a future devastated by heat-related death, the truth is that far more people die from cold than from heat. Further, mainstream climate science says that warming will be concentrated in colder places, northern latitudes, at colder times, at night, and during colder seasons. This is good news. It means fewer people will die from cold in the coldest places. Fact 7. The greenhouse effect is a diminishing phenomenon. As we're so often told, the greenhouse effect means that the more CO2 in the atmosphere, the warmer the climate. But that's not the full story. As CO2 levels rise, warming slows down and levels off. This is mainstream climate science, but it's rarely communicated to the general public because it contradicts the climate catastrophe narrative. Fact 8. Projected climate impacts can be managed with fossil fuels. The most plausible threat of a warming climate is a rapid rise in sea levels because our coastal infrastructure was built around modern sea levels. But even extreme UN projections put that rise at 3 feet over the next 100 years. That's hardly something to panic over. A good part of the Netherlands is below sea level, including its international airport. The technology the Dutch use to keep the sea at bay is available to any country that needs it. Let's return to our original principle. Carefully weigh the benefits and the negative side effects. If we do this for fossil fuels, the balance is incredibly positive. So do what you would do if fossil fuels were a prescription drug. Take the pill. I'm Alex Epstein, author of Fossil Future for Prager University.
Everyone has heard the expression, "Let your conscience be your guide." In fact, many people base their entire moral life on the idea that their conscience will keep them from doing bad things. I have something very important to tell you. It won't. Not for most people, and not most of the time. Throughout Western history, people took it as a given that the conscience was not enough, that God and God-based moral instruction were also necessary. That so many people believe today that the conscience is all they need to act morally is a product of modern secular society. In fact, it's just one more example of the many irrational ideas that our secular society has produced. Others include men give birth, Western civilization is no better than any other, and if you're colorblind, you're racist. But none of these beliefs is more irrational than the belief that the conscience is all you need, that it can replace God, the Bible, and Judeo-Christian values as a producer of moral behavior. The reality is that most people's consciences are, to say the least, easily manipulated. It is hard to imagine any aspect of human life more malleable than the conscience. It's as malleable as putty and as sturdy. If the conscience were morally effective, what evildoer or supporter of evil would sleep well at night? Yet people who commit evil, whether for personal reasons, such as murderers, thieves, and rapists, or for ideological reasons, such as Nazis, communists, and Islamic terrorists, sleep as soundly as anyone else. Also, if the conscience were morally effective, why doesn't it stop anyone who commits evil from doing so? That alone should end the issue, but let's continue. Virtually every individual who has committed or supported evil has had a clear conscience. That's why "I let conscience be my guide" is meaningless intellectually and morally. Most people get it backwards. People's feelings and behavior produce their conscience. Their conscience doesn't produce their feelings and behavior. Most people do either what they want to do and then tell their conscience that what they did was right, or their feelings decide what is right and they label those feelings conscience. Here's another proof that the conscience is largely useless in directing moral behavior. People on the opposite sides of every conflict are equally convinced they are listening to their conscience. Take the morally clear example of World War II. German soldiers and concentration camp guards followed their consciences, but so did the Allied troops and leaders who fought them. The Western spies who gave atom bomb secrets to the great mass murderer, Joseph Stalin, followed their consciences, but so did the anti-communists who opposed Stalin. Even the Japanese soldiers, who used Korean women as comfort women, women they gang raped day after day, all followed their consciences. But so did the Allied troops and leaders who fought the Japanese in World War II. The list is endless. And we don't need the extreme example of World War II. People who believe the human fetus has a right to live, unless its death is necessary to save the life of the mother, and those who do not believe the human fetus has a right to live unless the mother wants it to, are both equally convinced their consciences dictate their views. People who believe it is moral to surgically remove the healthy breasts of any girl or young woman who says she is a boy have a completely clear conscience, as do those who think this act constitutes mutilation. Given the moral unreliability of the conscience, conscience means little more than what one feels is right or wrong. In other words, in most people, conscience is just a euphemism for what I feel. So then, given the frequent uselessness of the conscience, how is one to be morally guided? And the answer is by building a conscience. The conscience we are born with needs to be developed just like the muscles we are born with need to be developed. It takes four things: truth, because lies are the mother of evil; courage, because good is impossible without it; God, that is the God of the Bible; and reason, because God without reason leads to fanaticism, and because reason without God leads to moral chaos. In fact, irony of ironies, reason without God ends with the death of reason. Unless, of course, you believe men give birth is rational. So you can let your conscience be your guide, but only if you build it properly, with truth, courage, God, and reason. I'm Dennis Prager. Thank you for watching this video. To keep PragerU videos free, please consider making a tax-deductible donation.
According to a 2022 Real Clear Politics poll, 72% of Americans support school choice, the ability of parents to choose the school that best fits their children's needs. 82% of Republicans, 68% of Democrats, and 67% of Independents. Given how divided Americans are over almost everything, that's about as bipartisan as it gets. And given that politicians read the polls, school choice should be a slam dunk, right? Well, let's take a look at Texas. You can't get much more conservative than the Lone Star State. So you'd think it would have a very robust school choice program, but you'd be wrong. In Texas, public education doesn't look all that different from progressive California or New York. And it shares equally embarrassing educational test results. According to the National Assessment of Educational Progress, 75% of Texas 8th graders are not proficient in reading and math. The state's own assessments are just as grim. 60% of students cannot do math at grade level, and nearly 50% cannot read at grade level. This is a Texas-sized problem, and it needs a Texas-sized solution. That solution is school choice. So what's the problem? Why isn't it a slam dunk? Why is a state that has led on such cutting-edge initiatives as medical liability and tort reform fallen behind on a critical issue like education. Here's what those who oppose school choice will tell you. If you offer parents choice, the public schools will lose funding. Money needed for public schools, which must accept all students, will be siphoned off to competing charter schools or private schools or someplace else. But this concern is misplaced. In states where school choice already has a long history, most parents do not leave their local school for another school. Why aren't they heading for the exits? Here's where it gets interesting and instructive. In states where parents have choice, public schools improve. When Florida first implemented their school choice program in 2002, they were ranked number 33 in the nation for educating low-income students. By 2019, they had risen to number 1 in the nation. Indiana, similarly, went from number 22 in the nation to number 3 with low-income students in the same period of time after implementing choice. All this improvement happened without parents abandoning their local schools. Look at it this way. What parent doesn't want their local school to be a good school? Answer, zero. School choice does not destroy public schools. It makes them better. And of course, if a public school is already a good one with good outcomes, then students and parents won't want to use their choice option. Nothing will change. But if a school is failing and its test scores are poor and they don't make improvements, then parents will have an option to go elsewhere. Just that consequence, just giving that power to the parents, will push the failing schools to do better. That's what the data tells us. And if a school still can't cut the mustard, then, and only then, do parents look for an alternative. In short, the argument that school choice will drain money away from public schools has been proven false. People are starting to get it. In 2022, in a truly landmark piece of legislation, Arizona passed a school choice bill that gives parents an education scholarship account of anywhere from $7,000 per student to more than $30,000 for students with special needs. The money follows the student, not the school. This simple change changes everything. Successes like these have accelerated the wave of new choice programs across the country. Iowa, Utah, and Arkansas have hopped on the school choice bandwagon in 2023. More states are poised to come on board. Texas has a great chance to be one of them. If Texas passes a robust school choice law, it would very likely see the same results Florida and Indiana have seen. Everybody wins. The school choice movement would be unstoppable. And what, after all, is this movement really about? Freedom. Freedom for parents to choose the best educational option for their children. School choice is the way. It makes everybody, students and teachers, better. This isn't politics. It's just common sense. As Nebraska State Senator Justin Wayne, a Democrat, put it, this is about parents and students wanting something better, wanting to access the American dream. Isn't that what we all want? I'm Mandy Drogan of the Texas Public Policy Foundation for Prager University.
What does the name James K. Polk mean to you? Probably not much, if anything at all, and that's a shame, especially considering all he accomplished in just 4 years, from 1845 to 1849. As the 11th president of the United States, he acquired the Oregon Territory from the British, carried out the annexation of Texas, and then waged a successful war with Mexico that ended with the U.S. acquiring California and the Utah and New Mexico territories. In doing so, he increased the nation's size by a third, transforming America into a truly continental nation, from sea to shining sea. Just look at a map of the United States. We have Polk to thank for much of it. You'd think he'd have his own monument in Washington, D.C. And that's not all he did as president. He reduced taxes, stimulated the economy, and reformed the government's banking practices. Plus, the California Gold Rush of 1848 made his acquisition of the Golden State look like a stroke of genius. Born on November 2, 1795, young James grew up marinating in the politics of his father, Samuel Polk, a Tennessee county judge, and a devoted follower of Thomas Jefferson. Samuel saw the world as a struggle between the virtuous farmer and the crafty banker, the city versus the country, the common man versus the wealthy elite. His son James never strayed far from this worldview. After graduating with honors from the University of North Carolina in May 1818, Polk moved to Nashville. There, he established a law practice and, like so many ambitious young men of his day, used his legal career as a springboard into politics. He was elected to the Tennessee State Legislature in 1823. There, he came to the attention of General Andrew Jackson, the hero of the War of 1812. The two men formed a father-son bond that became so close that Polk earned the nickname Young Hickory to Jackson's Old Hickory. Polk got himself elected to the U.S. Congress in 1825, shortly after Jackson had lost to John Quincy Adams in one of the most controversial presidential elections in American history. Polk proved his loyalty to the general by becoming a persistent thorn in Adams' side. When Jackson came roaring back to win the presidency in 1828, Polk was right there with him as an advisor and confidant. As a Jackson insider, Polk rose quickly, becoming the chairman of the Influential Ways and Means Committee, then Speaker of the House, then Governor of Tennessee. It seemed that every political door was opening to him. Then, suddenly, it all went south. Running for re-election as governor in 1841, Polk lost to an obscure, somewhat buffoonish Whig opponent, James Lean Jimmy Jones. Polk may have won on the issues, but his 6'2", 125-pound opponent won on crowd-pleasing humor. That was bad enough. But when Lean Jimmy beat Polk again in 1843, everyone assumed that Polk's once promising political career was over. Then, one year later, in 1844, everything changed again. The reason was Texas. The new Republic of Texas had achieved its independence from Mexico in 1836 and had been seeking to become part of the United States ever since. Fearing a war with Mexico, Congress wavered on Texas annexation for almost a decade. By 1844, however, American public opinion, bursting with expansionist fever, had undergone a massive shift in favor of annexation. Both Martin Van Buren, the likely Democratic nominee, and Henry Clay, the likely Whig nominee, misread the national mood. They publicly stated that they would oppose the annexation of Texas. They didn't realize it at the time, but this doomed their campaigns and cleared the way for a pro-annexation candidate. That candidate turned out to be Polk, who beat Van Buren for the Democratic nomination and then Clay for the presidency. At the age of 49, young Hickory became the youngest president the country had ever had. In the course of just a few months, he'd gone from the humiliation of defeat to the shining prize of the White House. His term of office will always be closely identified with the mid-19th century idea of manifest destiny, the belief that American democracy should extend from coast to coast, enveloping the entire continent. And that may be why today we do not always give him the credit he deserves. We tend to see manifest destiny in negative terms, as a form of American imperialism, pure and simple. But Polk never saw it that way. Along with most Americans of his day, the very ones who swept him into office, he was confident that what he was doing was noble and good, bringing freedom and prosperity across the continent to ever more people. Looking back almost two centuries, isn't that exactly what he did? I'm Wilfred McClay, professor of history at Kilsdale College and author of Land of Hope for Prager University. Thank you for watching this video. To keep PragerU videos free, please consider making a tax-deductible donation.